Hey, everybody, let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight is a great honor and a privilege to have John B. come back to the podium, actually to the desk, got the mic all set and ready. He spoke recently. Yeah? Something, not here.
Oh, yeah.
He got all that out of his system. He saved the good stuff for us tonight. Welcome, John.
Hey, thank you. Hey, y'all. When I say y'all, we talk real funny down here. Drink too much and we laugh too loud. Too dumb to make it in a northern crowd. But, you know, there's also a saying, American by birth, Southern by the grace of God. But that being said, I'm amazed. Well, anyway, it's an honor to be here. I guess I'll start at the beginning. I was born in Birmingham, Alabama, October the 14th, 1953. My father was an immigrant from Sicily, which is the largest island in the Mediterranean Sea for you who are geographically challenged. It's just off the, it's just south of Italy. My mom is what you call a CIA. That's a Catholic Irish alcoholic. And when they got together, it was like serious hell raising. And I'm the youngest of three children. I have an older brother and sister. A sister 6 years older than me and a brother 3 years older than me. And I was a low man on the totem pole. And I love my family, and I believe they love me. But there was a lot of violence. And for those of you who ever saw or the film or read the book, The Help, if you're familiar with that, I was raised from birth by an African-American woman who had already raised her children. And she could have done anything. She was so smart. She could have done anything in the world as she wanted to. But back then, there weren't a lot of economic opportunities for African-Americans in the South. But I believe that she would have wanted to do that anyway because she just loved children and it was her gift. And Mary Lyles is her name. And she showered me with love from the day I was born. She showered me with love. And she told me the story a bunch of times. She told me, she said, you know, when you were a newborn baby, you started crying really hard one time and your mom was sitting there knitting, doing something. And I said, aren't you going to pick that baby up? She said, no. If you pick up a baby every time when it cries, you spoil it. So apparently what happened to my older brother was he was just left in that crib to cry his eyes out. So because of that, he never learned how to form bonds with other people. And actually developed a personality disorder, a narcissistic personality disorder. Now, there was a brief period where we moved to Dallas, Texas. Then this is my first memory of life. I was 3 years old. I played in the front yard. And you know, in Texas, they say everything is bigger. Okay? Well, I was out there playing in the front yard, and had on these shorts that had an elastic waistband. He slipped up behind me with the shovel full of fire ants. Pulled back my shorts and dumped those fire ants in. Well, from there, our relationship went downhill. And I'm not bragging or complaining, but he, my brother, used to beat my ass every day, several times a day, for exercise, I guess. And, I mean, I've always been told all my life that he's a genius. And I don't know if you ever saw the movie Arsenic and Old... Anybody ever see the movie Arsenic and Old Lace? Well, and there... what he would do is he'd tie me up with ropes in ways that if I would try to escape, it would strangle me. And that's what my childhood... My childhood was like... I mean, I never knew what I'd get. One minute, it'd be real nice. The next minute, he'd be doing something awful. He would... Whenever we'd have enough money to buy a drink, we'd buy it, usually a Dr. Pepper. He'd take the first sip, and then he'd say, "I spit in it." So I couldn't get any of it. And anyway, so life went on and on. And my mom, I went to Catholic school as a kid. And I'm not knocking Catholicism, so don't anybody jump on me, okay? This is just my experience, because I know it's got to be a great religion. I mean, there's more Catholics than on all the other religions, you know, Christians combined. So, I remember the very first day of school, I go to school, and I remember I had to go to the bathroom. And Sister Emily was like, she wouldn't let me go. She made me sit there in my desk and piss in my pants. And not just me, but the kid next to me. And I think the whole idea was to show that she was in charge and that she had power over me. But actually, all it really did was just piss me off. And I was really unruly. I used to get in fights every day. And long before, says problems other than alcoholism, I saw it and I grabbed it. Way before I started drinking, I was doing crazy stuff. I would create charities and go out and collect for them, you know? I mean, this honest little kid. Well, anyway, one thing led to another and another. My mom's drinking got worse and worse, and ended up in a foster home for a while. And finally, we moved over here to Georgia, where things finally got so bad, my folks split up. And eventually, my brother got old enough. He moved in with my father because my dad gave him a car. And it was just my mother and me. And there used to be these three numbers you could dial, these three digits you could dial. When you'd hang the phone up, Bell South would make your phone ring. That's how they checked to make sure that the phone worked. So, I dialed in those three numbers, and back then there used to be these two prongs that would come up on your phone, you know? And so the phone started, and I taped down one of those prongs. The phone started ringing. My mom was drunk. Well, did I tell you, she was drunk every day of my life growing up. And so the phone started ringing, and like I said, I was a 13-year-old pain in the ass. So she says, "Get over here, you better get over here and fix this phone right away." So I go over there, and as I'm taking the tape off the phone, all of a sudden, I felt something hit me in the head, and the force of the blow knocked me to the floor. And I'm laying there on the floor, and I remember reaching up to touch the top of my head. And right as I did, blood came flowing into my eyes. And my mom was standing over me. And I said, "Ma, I think you hurt me." And she said, "I hope you die, you little bastard." And it was right then that something inside of me kind of shifted. And I went from being a little pain in the ass to constantly running away from home. and hanging out with these. Oh, by the way, we lived in Oglethorpe. I don't know if y'all know Oglethorpe Apartments. It was over there where Blackburn Park is now. It was a rough place. And so I started hanging out with older guys, and they were always stealing stuff. And I brought this with me. It might help you also. But anyway, so I started hanging out with these older guys and stealing stuff. Mostly I was there along for the ride. And I got locked up for this and that. And finally, by the time I was 14, a friend of mine's mama had a GM. I don't know if you remember those old GM. Some of you, I know you remember those old GM cars. If you didn't turn it all the way off and pull the key out, you could start it without a key. So my buddy's mama had a white Corvair station wagon, which is like one in a million. And we sneak that car out to go do this job. Let me back this up. There were these college students who were the lifeguards. They went to Oglethorpe University. They were lifeguards for our apartments at the pool. And they hired us, and they would pay us off in this stuff called swizzle, which was like carbonated Valley High. I mean, it was really nasty, but you would get a buzz on it. So they had bought every bit of swizzle that was in town, and they had it at Happy Herman's. And so they'd hire us to do jobs, so we'd do stuff for them. And we were supposed to go steal this carpet for them one night, but we didn't. But on the way back, we got pulled over by Chambly police. And here I am, 14 years old, and it was my third arrest by then. Third or so, fourth, I'm not. And auto larceny. And I was looking at some serious time. And this one guy, Mike, I still remember. I'll just say Mike G, ratted us out and blamed it all on Kenny and me. And I'll never forget, part of my probation was that I could never go back to that neighborhood and hang out with those old friends. And that probably saved my life. Because today I know that Kenny died in prison and Mike Glass became a recidivist. And the last thing I heard about him, he was robbing jewelry stores and still ratting people out. I mean, you know, once a rat, yeah, okay. That's why with me, I don't know nothing. You know, give me a lawyer. Well, anyway, so finally, when I was 15, I found my drug of choice. I know this is AA, but I got to tell you, I found my higher power, which was LSD. And that stuff took me. You know, I when I would drink with my friends, I would drink till I'd either pass out or throw up every time. I drank alcoholically from 13 or 14 on. But the hangovers were horrific. But I found acid, and that was like, that took me places that the other stuff wouldn't. I became a white punk on dope. I ended up downtown at the Strip. I know some of you heard of it. It was an open-air drug market. And I was dealing acid on the Strip at 16. By the time I got to be 17, dealing acid and speed, I was so burned out. I remember going to see my brother-in-law, and he's like, well, you know, what would probably be good for you would be to join the Army. Okay? So I joined the Army, which is what some people call taking a geographic cure. That's moving to another place to escape your drug problem. Well, after I joined the Army, I discovered joining the Army to get away from drugs is like moving to Milwaukee to get away from beer. You know? And there I found a whole smorgasbord of stuff. And I got orders for Vietnam. I joined at 17. I turned 18. Got orders for Vietnam. And I came home on leave. My leave was up 2 days before Thanksgiving. So I said, Mom, let me go upstairs and see if they'll give me a few days extra. So I went upstairs and called. I said, Sarge, can I have a couple of days extra so I'll be with my family on Thanksgiving? He said, Soldier, If you're not here on time, your ass is AWOL. So I hung the phone up. I went downstairs and said, Ma, they said I could stay a whole week. When that week was up, I moved to Decatur, where the Fidelity National Bank is. It was Marshall Street. I moved in with these guys who are today in the program. Do you hear me? I mean, we partied our asses off. And today, we're in the program of recovery. So, there's always hope. Never give up. Never give up. Miracles happen. This is a program of miracles. And so anyway, I don't know how I did it, but I did 3 years in the service, got an honorable discharge, I got out, and became an entrepreneur, which means I started dealing reefer and going to school. Somehow, and I don't know how I got involved with this woman who knew me from the eighth grade. We were in the same homeroom in the eighth grade. She knew I was crazier than hell. And still, anyway, so the next thing you know, we're married. And I'm going to school on the GI Bill. And this girl, we got out of classes early. This girl says, I know this place, and it's so beautiful. You know, let's go over to this place. So go to these woods over here behind the VA. And they were like heaven on earth. Yeah, I could walk back then and all. And it was so beautiful. And we started drinking. The next thing I know, she kissed me. I kissed her back. Well, anyway, we end up having sex right there. In these woods, the leaves falling all around us. It was like this time of year. And I felt so guilty, I couldn't go home. And at the time, I worked at a Shakey's Pizza. I went to Shakey's and drank and closed and drank and drank and drank and drank. I went home. And Debbie opened the door, and I knew as soon as she opened the door, she's going to see cheating son of a bitch right across my forehead. But she didn't. She was so happy to see me. But see, I knew what I had done. And the guilt was just so overwhelming. And I don't know, I started drinking and drinking. And let me tell you, of all the drugs I did, alcohol. People say what they want. Alcohol is a drug. It is. It's from what I understand, it's a class 3 narcotic. And it took over my life. And I started drinking every day, every night. And I had a job that was destroyed by alcohol. Started doing construction. I went to the Downwind Lounge over at DeKalb Airport, Peachtree DeKalb Airport, and on an open mic night, I was doing construction during the day, and the guy who owned the place, can't remember his name. Anyway, he's a good dude, though. He used to play bass with Waylon Jennings, and he liked my harp playing. And I started playing the harmonica when I was 16. I took up the guitar at 22. So he liked what I did. He says, I'll tell you what, if you come in here every night and be the opening act, I'll give you all you can drink and all you can eat every night. And I'm like, I mean, it was a drunkard's dream. So I started doing that. Well, one night after I gotten through playing, it was like 2 in the morning, I've been playing, I was the opening act for this band named The Lobsters. This guy I went to high school who works for Epps Air Service came in, Charlie, with this other guy. He says, John, you want to go for a ride in the plane? I said, hell yeah. I said, is everything cool? He says, yeah, everything's fine. So we go for a ride in this plane, we're flying all over, it's like in July or August of 77 or so. Flying all over the place, it was beautiful. We came back to land the plane. It was a twin-engine Cessna. And I'm on the back bench. As we come to land, the back wheels touch down. That's perfect. And I'm watching that dude. He's moving all this stuff around. The nose goes down. All of a sudden, sparks start flying. We're skidding all over the damn runway. We comes sliding to a stop. Charlie turns around and says, John, we got to haul ass. Because this idiot just crashed a stolen airplane. So we take off running like crazy. The wrong direction. Oh, I didn't tell you. I was the best runner in the state of Georgia, 2 miler. And my, I was an exceptional. When I was in the Army, they used to bet money on me. Well, anyway, we're running the wrong way. I finally say, Charlie, what the hell? My car's back there, man. So we turn around. I'll leave him in the dirt. I get to my car and I dive in there. And I'm waiting after a few minutes. He comes flying in the window. And in the meantime, while all this had happened, another plane came and landed. And apparently saw what happened. Finally, I start up the car. And as we're pulling out, one cop car after another comes flying in. We go out the other way. It was a week later, the guy who had crashed the plane comes in and says, John, I got somebody I want you to meet. And right then I knew my ass was grass. So we go outside and I'm drinking a beer. In the middle of the conversation, this guy reached out, smashed the beer out of my hand. He goes crashing up against the wall. He puts the cuffs on me and says, you're going to jail. And, well, anyway, that, yeah, I could tell you a lot more bad stuff that happened. I remember one time, my buddy and I went to see the Ali Spinks last fight. And got a good buzz. He took me back to my car. I was like, I'll be damned if he's going to get to wherever we're going before me. I stomped out on it, pulling out of the parking lot. I was in my truck. And right as I did, a Doraville cop goes by the other direction. I look in my window, those lights go on. So I dug down the next street. I pull in his driveway, and he was on me like white on rice. He pulls me out of the car, and as he pulls me out, he says, oh, by the way, you're in the mayor's driveway. Yeah. So I go see a lawyer, and the lawyer's like, okay, and this is like in 77. You can get, 78. You can get 2 years in jail, $2,000 fine, and lose your license. So we go to the judge. And my boss goes back there with me and says, look, he's a great employee, comes in every day, and all this good stuff. So they only fined me $400 and didn't take my license. I was overjoyed. Well, as I'm going to work the next day, Debbie stops me at the door and she says, it's like this. I can't afford you anymore. I want you out of here by the end of the month. In all the years I knew that woman, that's the best thing she ever did. Because I went out, I got hooked up with a crazy woman who's crazy as hell like me, and we partied our asses off. We partied to hell. And the next thing you know, I wake up in this dump. Everything that I owned of value was in the pawn shop. I didn't have a car, but I had a job. Had a roof over my head. I was hungover and broke. Everything was gone. And I was like, I can't be an alcoholic. I've got a job. So I quit drinking. I was going to quit drinking. Well, I wasn't going to drink ever again. Well, you know what? I woke up the next morning in the exact same shape. Hungover, sick as a dog, flat broke. Right then, I resolved to quit drinking, and I did. I quit drinking on my own. And things got better and better, and I got promotions on the job. I started going to school at night on the GI Bill. Plus, my job was paying me to go to school. Things got better. I got the good-looking girlfriend. I got the car. Everything got better and better and better and better. Finally, one night, these buddies of mine came by and said, hey, man, you'll go out for a drink? So I said, sure. So I got to have a drink with these guys. That was on a Friday night. Woke up Saturday morning in a drainage ditch off of Fulton Industrial Boulevard. This guy nudging me with his foot. I staggered out of the drainage ditch. And a cop car pulled up and said, we had a report of a dead body over here on the side of the road. You think that was you? I said, I guess so. So he puts me in his car to get me out of his jurisdiction. I hitchhike home. The next thing I know, that was on a Saturday at the end of June. The next thing I know, I wake up. It was like July the 6th or 7th. I was in the intensive care unit at Shalford Hospital. I woke up paralyzed. And I got in a blackout and got in a car accident, blacked out. And my injury levels at C5 and 6. And I had a friend who was a C5. All he could do is move his head. And my injury level was C5 and 6. But I was in a coma for a week, and my injury level dropped down to T1. When I first woke up, my hands were numb, but they got better. Finally, you see? Anyway, my mind was made up. There's no way I was going to live like this. And I actually attempted suicide twice. But some things you just can't kill. And I guess I'm one of them. Well, I lived wasted for 5 years. And finally, I was at this Kroger one night. I heard these two guys talking about having a drug problem. I said, "What are you talking about?" This guy turns around and says, "My name is Scoop. And I'm a drug addict." And I wanted to crawl under a rock. You know, he embarrassed me so much. He says, "Are you a vet?" I said, "Yeah." He pulls out his business card, gives it to me. He says, "Look, I'm in charge of the drug treatment program at the VA. You come see us." So I went there and they gave me a list. Said, "You need to go to Narcotics Anonymous." So I went to this NA meet every day for 5 days at noon. Nobody showed up. So I go on a Sunday night. And I was so wasted. I had on these glasses that were so scratched up. I don't know how I saw out of them. Had a long, scraggly beard. My eyes were glazed over at half-mast. Probably had a little spittle coming out of my mouth. I mean, I was wasted. When they go to give out chips, to get to the white chip, you know, and I felt so, my self-esteem was so low. I felt like I did not deserve it. I didn't deserve it. But somebody says, "Man, don't you want to get a chip, dude?" I said, "Okay." And for some reason, they asked me, "Do you want to say anything?" Which they usually don't. At least I've never seen it happen a whole lot. And I said, "Yeah. I just want to live. I just want to live." And then all these people gathered around me with love. And one of them was a nurse. And she found out what I was on. She said, "Buddy, try coming off all that. You'll have a seizure or a stroke. You got to go through treatment." So I went through Bridgeview, which was a 28-day program. They kept me 45 days. They kept saying every week, they say, "John, Mary, you're doing great. You can go home this week. Bob, you're doing really good. You can go to the movies. John, you're not going to make it. You can't go anywhere." And they would never let me go anywhere. Finally, after 45 days of a 28-day program, when I left, they followed me and made me go to the DeKalb Addiction Clinic, went in with me and made me sign up for their program, which I was there for a long damn time. And saved my life. You know, a lot of stuff's happened. Both my parents died. My father died while I was in treatment. He woke me up early that morning. They didn't even have to tell me. I already knew it. My mom died 10 years later. When that happened, I felt like I'd lost my mind. But, you know, when I got here, I hated everybody and everyone because I hated myself. You know? I mean, I hated myself. I remember when I was in high school and I shaved off, I had a beard. And I used to have a red beard, believe it or not. And I had kind of red hair when I was, younger. My mama said she prayed every day for a red-headed baby. I don't know. But anyway, I remember this girl came in to school and they said, "What happened to that cute guy? He shaved off his red beard." And I was like, "Who the hell is she talking about?" Because I didn't even know I had a red beard, because I could not stand to even look at myself in the mirror. That's how much I hated myself. But like I said, I finally got in here. You know, I was going to a place called the Highland Club, which was Narcotics Anonymous. And they moved to a building that was wheelchair inaccessible. And it pissed me off. I mean, I was one angry. You don't know. I mean, you don't know what angry was. Some of you might have known me back then. I was one angry dude. And when they moved, I went to my buddy Mark. I said, "Man, these sons of a," you know. And he was like, "John, well, I know a place that's wheelchair accessible. It's called the Dogwood Club." So I started going to this place called the Dog. Well, we called it the Dog. And I'll never forget the very first day there was a woman named Lee. And she was like, "I love you, son. Now you just keep on coming back." And nobody had ever done that. Nobody ever wanted me to come back anywhere before. You know what I mean? People were always glad to get rid of me. Can anybody here relate to that? You're damn right. Well, I'm looking at this motley group. I can understand it. No, I'm just joking. Y'all are beautiful. You are. I'm serious. This program saved my life. I mean, you know, it's like there's principles down these steps. There's 12 steps, 12 principles. First one's honesty. Now, I'm not going to lie to you and tell you I'm always honest, but I sure as hell try, you know? Because like Mark Twain said, if you tell the truth, you don't have to remember anything, you know? Second principle is hope. My life was absolutely, positively, completely hopeless when I got here. Today, I've got dreams, hopes and dreams. I mean, you know, it's like I'm 61. But in my heart, I'm still a, you know what I mean? There's a young man in here. I mean, it's like I got hopes and dreams. I love people, which is something I didn't before. The third principle is faith. You know, when we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of love and higher power, it doesn't say my life, it says our lives. And I believe that means I got to turn all this stuff over. You know, because number one, I don't know what's best for me. You know, after I got paralyzed, you know, when I was in high school, I was such a great runner, I'd always lap the other kids and leave them in the dirt. And I had this overwhelming fear of losing the use of my legs. Terrified. And if any of you know me, you've heard the story. Terrified of it. I told myself, if I ever get where I can't run, I'm going to kill myself. Well, around 81, I saved up a bunch of Valiums, like 108 Valiums, and slept for I don't know how many days. And I came to, I was like, damn. So I asked this pharmacist, would 100 Valiums kill you? He said, not necessarily. But if you ate 100 Valiums and drank some alcohol, it'd kill the hell out of you. So I went to this Chinese restaurant, ate my last meal. It was on North Highland. Went across the street to what was Superior Foods. Got a fifth of wine. Went back to my apartment. Ate those 100 Valiums. Drank a fifth of wine. All I know is that, like, on Tuesday, several days later, I came to. I was a scab from head to toe. I'd fallen out of bed, had indoor-outdoor carpet, kept trying to get back into bed. And I was just a huge sore. And that's right then, it's like, God's got a plan for me. And it's like, God wants me to stick around, so I believe I will. Trust behind the fourth step is courage. It takes a hell of a lot of courage to make a list. Take a personal inventory. Are you kidding me? You know what? I mean, there's a reason for these steps. I mean, you know, the very first guy I sponsored, we called him Cadillac Steve. Anybody here remember Cadillac Steve from the Dogwood? He always drove a Cadillac. And Steve looked up at the steps. He said, "Damn, you know, I think if I do those, hell, it's like I'll be brainwashed." But he said, "Come to think of it, with a brain like this, damn thing probably needs to be washed." You know? Man, when I did that, you know, first off, though, I got to tell you, when I was in treatment, they had me make a list. They said, "Make a list of everything bad ever happened as a result of your alcohol, drug abuse." 5 minutes. 5 minutes, then I got to shut up. Make a list of everything bad that ever happened as a result of your drug use. Be alcohol being a drug. When I made that list, I saw I got my first DUI when I was 15. I went into treatment to get off of those Valiums. All of a sudden, I saw all these other things that happened as a result of all these other drugs. When it's in black and white, there's no denying it. And I recommend for each and every body here that we all make a list, you know. And then when I got together with another person and share with them, sometimes they tell me, "Oh, you mean your chicken lived?" That was supposed to be funny, you know. Now, actually, I remember the very first fifth step I did. I did it with a very sick individual that I fired shortly thereafterward and got the sponsor that I have now. As far as defects of character, they had to spread that over a couple of steps because, baby, let me tell you, I got plenty of them, you know. When I made a list of all the people I had harmed, you know, I've done things in my life that I'm not proud of. And there are things I've done in my life that you could not make me do today. You know what I mean? You couldn't make... You don't have enough money. Money? There's not enough of anything in the world that you make me do some of the sorry shit that I did. And when I made amends, I've made amends to people. And for the most part, my wife, I'll never forget when I met, like, I used to have to grovel every time. I used to run into her around town. She's like, "You low-lying scum sucking man." This is how I felt about it. When I went and made amends under the program, she was like, "John, no wonder you're crazy. Look at that family you came from." You know? And when I continue to take personal inventory, that's my way of saying, "Look, I'm a human being. I made a mistake." And that's powerful. You know what I mean? I don't have to carry that guilt with me over and over because guilt is so powerful. I brought this book, Meditation for Everyday Living. I believe in all these steps. I especially believe in the 11th step. We sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact. You know, I would rather have a conscious contact with my higher power, God, if you want to call it, than all the money, than $20 billion. Because if I'm doing what God wants me to do, I'm going to be doing the right thing. I'm not going to be making mistakes. I'm going to be living a life of love, which is what I believe this program is about. And having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, try to carry this message to other alcoholics and practice principles all our affairs. I don't believe that. I don't believe that we're supposed to carry this message to just other alcoholics. I believe that we're supposed to carry it to everyone. Every person we meet. Because everyone that we meet, every person has a burden. Everybody's got trouble. We need to let them know, "Hey, man, it's going to be all right." You know? Because we have all been to hell. You know what I mean? I've heard it said that religions for people who are afraid to go to hell, afraid of going to hell, AA is for people who've been there. And we all been through hell. We all been there. But baby, we're in heaven today. And this has been a huge honor for me. And before I go, I'd like to tell you, my brother, who has this narcissistic personality disorder, I truly believe in my heart, loves me. And if I needed him, he would be there for me because he loves me. I've seen him get his ass beat before by bigger guys because he jumped in there to protect me. Okay? So this is what I know. People are doing the best they can. I got to go. But before I go, I'll tell you one last thing. Yeah! Oh, yeah, yeah. And if you're interested in this book, it's really inexpensive. It's called Meditation for Everyday Living. It comes with a guided CD, but as soon as you put the CD on, the guy says, if you haven't read the book, turn it off and go read the book. Thank you. Oh, thanks, man. Thank you.
That was Johnny B. Good. A year after they crash-landed that plane, I got a job out of that. The fellow that was piloted was an employee.
Oh, yeah.
And he came back after a year in jail to make his amends, but he didn't get his job back. But he felt better for it. But, Don, he played before the meeting where Lyle Prowse, the Northwest Airlines pilot, in the Big Book. He celebrated 21 years here a few years back, and John performed a few songs before, and then it dawned on me that we had two FUIs in the same room that night. And never forget it. John, thank you.
Thank you, man. It's an honor.
Feel good, sleeping on a concrete bench. Can I get a witness? I'm in South Carolina, 1975. Somebody stole your crown. You were sleeping in your happy home. When you woke up, babe, your life had come and gone. Now you're mystified. Standing with the rest of us, who used to rule the world. Brother Lovejoy, wrapping up a pink streak. Can I get a witness? I miss Hurricane, you can't keep your hands still long enough to count your change. Up in your daily grind, the cost of living, it didn't even cross your mind. Now you're mystified, standing with the rest of us. Who you do rule the world? Car. And this cocktail press, looking in the bathroom sink. Anybody find a ring? Anybody find a ring? And you can't believe your very eyes. Everything you were counting on, nothing but a pack of lies. Now you're mystified, down with the rest of us.